Happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. And we're going to begin our program today by taking a look at the state of agriculture. For the past few years, Gary Holthaus, who is the author of From the Farm to the Table, What All Americans Need to Know About Agriculture, has been talking with and learning from people who understand, as best any of us can, how agriculture works. He's visited with farm families in Minnesota, in Iowa, and here in Wisconsin, and talked with experts from the universities that are concerned with it. And it's been part of a project called the Experiment in Rural Cooperation. I've had a chance to, I haven't read his entire book, but I've read quite large parts of it, and I'm really happy to have him with us today to talk about it. Certainly, if you have questions as we move along today, you are most welcome to join in. The number to call if you're in the Madison area is 263-1890, 263-1890. Anywhere else, it's toll-free at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Gary Holthaus with us by phone. Gary, hi. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Happy to be here.
Must have been an interesting time. You talked with a lot of farmers.
I did, and that was a really great experience. All kinds of farmers, and they were so generous with their time and with their ideas and with their explanations of what they were doing and why they were doing it. It was a real high the whole time.
Yeah, the whole time. And you talked to... You didn't limit yourself to just big farms or small. You talked to a wide range of farmers from many different perspectives.
I did. And along the way, I wound up sort of making some choices about who to feature in the book. And I wound up choosing folks that I thought were going to still be farming 20 years from now. And that, I think, was an important kind of decision for me to make, an opportunity, I guess. I couldn't include everybody, but everybody taught me something, and so that part of it was really an educational experience for me. It was just great.
Yeah, and as we think about it, we look at farm numbers declining. You must have had to do a little figuring to think of who might still be there 20 years from now.
You know, about three-quarters of the way through the project, I guess, it occurred to me that the guys who are most vulnerable, given the economy and given the forces that are coming at us from climate change and the end of cheap oil and the decline of water and the loss of topsoil and all the rest, that the most vulnerable ones were probably the major transnational corporations, and the guys who were still going to be farming 20 years from now were the ones who were doing it with the least oil and with the most sustainable methods.
Yeah. Who did you write this book for, by the way?
Well, people asked me that early on in the project, who's this book for? And I have a little backwards notion, I guess, about that. I didn't know what the story was going to be when I started. And so I didn't know who, quote, my audience was going to be, end quote. And what I talked with folks about was the notion that first we had to discover what the story is, and then we had to figure out how to tell it, and then our audience would appear before us, so to speak. I didn't want to write it for a particular audience because it seemed to me the story of agriculture in America and around the world is really an important story for everybody because we all eat and we're all participants in a food system that at the moment is not sustainable and doesn't do a very good job of feeding us. So I guess I think the audience is anybody who's the least bit interested in any of those issues.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the farmers themselves that you talked with, and some of those obviously stood out in your mind. Describe the farmers and talk a little about their operations.
One of the men I talked to early on didn't show up in an individual interview in the book, although his name comes up a lot, because everybody in the North Central region admires him, and folks who know him, he lives in Southeast Minnesota, folks who know him admire him a lot, and they quote him a lot, and they cite what he's trying to do. He milks 80 Ayrshires, and he milks them twice a day. They're not computerized. He doesn't push them for higher production. He hasn't had a sick cow in years, no mastitis, no creaky joints and weak legs. And he rotational grazes them on steep hillsides in southeast Minnesota in the Blufflands country just above the Mississippi. And he has great pasture and great water retention. In fact, there's a story about him. I could go on about Art for a long time, Art and Gene Tickey I'm talking about. And some of your listeners will know those folks. There's a story that the DNR decided they were going to see if his pasture was as good as it seemed, and they brought a tank they normally haul fish around in, I guess, and dumped the equivalent of 4 inches of rain in a splash on his pasture, and then ran down the hill to see where it was going to run off, and there was no runoff. So he's doing something right. And the thing that interests me is that, unlike an awful lot of folks now, he doesn't even have to vaccinate. He doesn't use any antibiotics, doesn't need them. He says on his field days, we're interested in healthy soil, healthy animals, and healthy humans. And that's what he's doing, and he's paying off the mortgage faster than he thought he would. So 80 cows was about right for him. His inputs are really low, and he's doing fine. And he's going to be around, and he's still going to have pasture 20 years from now, 40 years from now. If he could live to be 400, he could still be farming that place.
What I think he might be typical in some ways of sort of the mindset of farmers, the farmers that you talked with, regardless of the type of operation they had. Is that a fair characterization?
Yes. There are wide variations. In fact, one of the jokes that sort of came up is that I was supposed to talk to conventional farmers too, and I tried to, but I never talked to a farmer any place who didn't have a peculiar twist that was all his own. And so it got to be kind of a joke. If nobody is doing it the same as anybody else, who is a conventional farmer? It's not just a matter of, raising corn and beans and commodity crops. It was everybody had some special practice that worked on their place, and they were quick to say, well, this works on my place, but I'm not sure it'll work on yours, or that doesn't mean it'll work on the one in the next county. So there was that awareness that, yes, there are differences that are important. I didn't talk to anybody who didn't want the farm to prosper in all ways. But
yeah, and there are a lot of obviously a lot of complexities, and you go through kind of the history a little bit, as told in part by yourself, but also in part by the farmers that you talked with, about the changes that have taken place in agriculture over the years. And you cite certain times, I think 1950 or thereabouts was one of the times that you cite. But maybe you could give us a sort of a timeline on how agriculture has changed over the years.
I did run into some information that I found really interesting about the early days of agriculture in the Great Plains, Northern Plains, and in Minnesota in particular. But the guys started out. The real danger in agriculture, and danger has always been an element of farming throughout history. But in the earliest days in the Midwest, the big danger was from large animals, oxen, big workhorses, etc. But then as technology came along, all of a sudden there's danger from sickle blades. And as greater technology came along, lots of heavy equipment and things that can fall on you, et cetera. And the bigger the technology, it seemed like the greater the danger became. But, you know, the last 15 years, 20 years, maybe the biggest danger got to be stress. Everybody just working so hard, partly because you have to use that equipment, and to use it the best, you have to have more land. And instead of saving you time so that you could have a weekend to yourself, the big equipment seems to just add an element of extra work and more stress. And so the accidents that happened on the farm the last few years have almost always been because you've been working so hard you're not paying attention, yeah, or you're taking shortcuts, and that's what gets you. Yeah. An interesting shift there, it seemed to me.
Yeah, I remember reading about one farmer who said the worst invention that he could recall was the putting of lights on tractors.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
So yes. That now you can not only work all day, but you could work all night, too.
Right. Yeah, and that means the next morning, doing chores, you're going to do something stupid, and you're going to get hurt. So people work awful hard at avoiding that, of course, but it's an exhausting as well as an intellectually demanding sort of a vocation.
A vocation, yeah, you bet. Earlier when we were talking, you mentioned that talked about the farmers who would be here 20
right.
years from now and 40 years from now and so forth, and one might have guessed that you would say that the big farms would, corporate farms would be around and not the small farms, but you're taking the opposite view?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Oh, it's really pretty simple. We are at the end of cheap oil. I can remember thinking, you know, a decade ago, well, we got 3 or 4 decades to fret about the end of cheap oil. And then all of a sudden it's down to a couple of decades, and now the folks who worry about that sort of stuff are talking about a decade or less. And I remember somebody toward the end of that project asked me what the price of oil was going to be in 2008, and I had no idea, of course. And so I just said the most outrageous thing I could think of, which was, oh, it's going to be $100 a barrel. And his jaw dropped, and he shook his head. But here we are at over 90, over 95, I guess, in the last mm-hmm. couple of days. And now they're saying by the end of next year, it's going to be 150. What I think is that we can be assured of is that oil is going to fluctuate like it has this year, 71 to 80, 85. 79 to 89, et cetera, except the numbers are going to be higher. Next year it'll fluctuate from 100 to 120 or 150 if they're right. And I guess what that means is that anybody who's dependent on oil and on long-distance hauls isn't going to be able to do that anymore.
Mm.
One of the things farmers are finding this year is that, yes, corn is way up, wheat's way up, but the cost of inputs is way up, too.
Mm.
And so the margin isn't all that different.
Yeah. Gary Holthaus is our guest today. He is the author of From the Farm to the Table, What All Americans Need to Know About Agriculture. It's published by the University Press of Kentucky. If you'd like to join in with your own questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. If you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're taking a look at the state of agriculture today with Gary Holthaus, author of From the Farm to the Table, What All Americans Need to Know About Agriculture, published by the University Press of Kentucky. Again, if you want to join in, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. We're glad to get you on the air. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Jim in Upper Michigan is online, so let's go to Jim. Jim, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Is according, you know, the big farms, according to them, the big farms are going to go first. How is that possible when their profits are larger and the smaller farms, yes, they're dealing with smaller gas bills, but they're also dealing with smaller profits?
Okay, the profit issue. Are the large... Jim wants to know how the big farms are the ones that make the money, and so how are the little farms going to be able to stay in business?
Well, I think the misperception is that the small farms are not showing a profit.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I could point to the one I mentioned earlier, Art Dickey, who obviously is making enough profit to suit him. I don't think the big farms are making all that much profit. There's several things at work there. One is that some of the promised gains from technology seem to last a couple of years or 3 years maybe, and then dissipate. So they aren't as productive as they seem to be. There's an interesting paper on the multifunctionality of small farms, and one of the things it points out is that the most productive farms in the United States, and I guess I would extend that, it seems to be from other information, this would be true all around the world, it's probably 4 acres.
Yeah, I saw that in your book.
And there's this misperception that somehow or other the high profits go to the big guys. And I'm not sure that that's really true, for one thing. The small guys are making a better profit. And this year and last year, for the last few years, organic growers, and generally small growers, are making more money than more conventional farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a market that's growing or increasing. That's a sector of the ag economy that's increasing somewhere between 16 and 20, 21, 22% annually lately. And I do think there is a growing concern on the part of everybody about the quality of the food they're eating and its nutritional value and its taste. And what they're discovering is that the highly processed stuff that we've all been eating for years isn't nearly as tasty as fresh stuff. And it's not as tasty as the factory farm grown stuff is not as tasty as smaller, more organically grown stuff. So I guess I think there's going to be a big swing in the food system here. When the cheap oil goes, we're going to get very local very fast. And I guess one of my concerns is that we're not going to have time to create a food system that can actually feed us.
And you do point to a place in, I believe, a county in Minnesota that has an individual there sort of decided we've got to push local and has had some success.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Experiment and Row Cooperation, who first said there's a story to be told about agriculture in southeast Minnesota that is not in the media all the time, and it's a story of success and its smallness, the success of smallness. It's not just one county, but the experiment itself has been promoting a local food network, and the Minnesota Project is another organization in Minnesota that has been working hard at a local food system and has been getting food into trendy restaurants and as well as in farmers markets and increasing that opportunity for consumers. I now work for an organization called the Northern Plains Sustainable Agriculture Society over in North Dakota. And we're working and others are working around here to create more local markets for food. It gets a little more complicated in states that are sparsely settled because you still have a transportation issue just to get from a town of 900 to another town of 900.
Yeah. It's going on in Wisconsin as well.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Jim, I thank you for calling. I want to get Sharon from Eau Claire online. Sharon, hi to you. Thank you for calling.
Yes, good morning. I wanted to ask your speaker, based on his research, projects or enterprises that might add value to traditional farming operation on a small farm, 240 acres, in which it's already a cow-calf pasture operation and soybeans, corn, alfalfa, and so forth, but with enough land to add something to it. And I want him to frame it in terms of, you know, how best to cover startup costs and labor. And I should mention, too, that it is near a fairly large urban area. So, and I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thank you for calling.
You're asking a
whole you set up a business plan
there,
for sharing
of
there.
Which I'm not equipped to answer. But I guess if it were my operation, then you are already invested in cattle or other kinds of livestock in an operation that size, and you do have a chance to add some land to it. Everything works better if it's diverse, it seems to me. And the best way to handle weeds, for instance, is with other crops that kill those weeds for you. So you can do it without the inputs that are oil-based. But there are a number of folks I know or have talked with who are doing a variety of things. They're not only raising pigs, they're making sausage and they're making brats and they're selling them in the local co-op store as well as in the farmer's market or right off the farm, people coming to them. So there is that kind of value-added effort that can come from pigs or cattle, either one. And but it might also be, given your circumstances, that you'd be in a good position to be doing something with berries or other kinds of agricultural products that take a certain amount of value-added effort. I really shouldn't be offering even advice about this stuff because, you know, I'm just kind of tossing out there what I might think about doing if it were mine, and that's a whole different kind of advice, and it sounds to me like you really need, but I hope Sharon finds a course that she can really be happy with, because it sounds like what she's doing is really interesting and what she's thinking about.
Thanks, Sharon. Marie and Madison, it's your turn next. Hi, Marie.
Hi there, Larry, and yes, thank you for taking my call, and I'm so pleased and want to congratulate your guest on how realistic he is about the oil situation and the future of small farms. And, well, in Madison here, we do a lot with the local food production, and I also work with a group called Churches for Center for Land and People who are doing winter's farmer markets in the churches around Madison and other areas.
Oh, that's great to hear.
It's so important. Appraise our people of what's happening and that we all need to wake up to we need local food systems. So thanks much for the program, Larry, and thank you for your fine book, and I hope to get a copy of it.
Well, thanks. That whole thing is kind of fraught with, contradictions, I guess. We love to brag about American farmers feeding the world, and in fact, we don't feed the world. We don't come close, and food production is not the reason for that. It has to do with distribution, and it has to do with politics and other things. What I find sort of baffling about all that is just that I think it is realistic to worry about oil, but as a matter of fact, I don't think we have a whole lot of interest in feeding the world, and I wish we had a greater interest in feeding ourselves. We have, 12.5 million, 13.2 million kids who don't have food security in this country? That's outrageous. And it's one indicator either that we don't really care about kids or we don't really care about food systems. And I guess I think that's a tragedy. Mm. And I don't think we have a right in the world to brag about feeding the world or feeding America. We just don't do it very well.
Thanks, Marie. Larry in Kenosha, it's your turn. Hi, Larry.
Hi there. I'm an old farm boy, 59 years old, raised on a farm. I think my folks finally got rid of the cows when I went into service. My dad had to work out. He had to work in town. We had an 80-acre farm and about 13 or 15 milk cows. We would get mastitis once in a while. We'd eat everything from the chicken except for the bones.
Yeah.
And I just met a person in the grocery store today, and I, you know, told her what we used to eat, and you know, but we didn't know any better. Eat the feet, the head. We'd eat everything from the chicken.
Yep.
Because that was there, you know, and I don't remember having it that bad. And, you know, there was always food on the table and a roof over our head. But there was times when the cows would be drying up.
Right.
The bank would take $50 out of the check for a bank loan, and that was every 2 weeks. And there was times when there wasn't enough in the milk money to pay the bank note.
Yeah.
And my in-laws had a cabin up north with an outhouse, and I wouldn't go to it. I'd take off into the woods.
Yeah.
She says, you know, why did you do that for? And I, because we were talking about this about a month ago. I said, I was raised with an outhouse for up 10 years on the farm. I said, I spent 14 months in Vietnam with outhouses. I says, I don't care for outhouses. That's just me. But it, you know, but I also. It's like service, like the military service. Everybody, they should have to spend just a little bit of time on a farm to realize where their food is coming from, how much work is put into it to get it there before it even goes to the processing plant. And, you know, basically you plant your – we raised oats and once in a while corn – you plant it in the spring, you know, and you don't know what you're going to get come fall.
Yep.
And that's true. A comment on that, Gary?
Well, I think what Larry's describing is an experience that a lot of us over 45 anyway mm-hmm. have had. And that for a long time in America was a typical farm experience. And I think it's still a viable way to go, aside from the discomfort. I'm not suggesting that we need the outhouse still.
No.
But I do think we're going to get back to a certain kind of diversity that your farm probably had. And we're going to find ways to feed ourselves because we are imaginative people. But... a lot of it's going to wind up going back to old ways as well.
I latched on to Larry's comment about people understanding and knowing where their food's coming from, and I think that's part of some of the movement that's going on with agriculture, with the sort of local CSAs,
yep.
and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, that's really part of the picture now, and it's an important part. And increasingly important part. So I'm all for that. I guess I worry that we may not have enough time to create a local food system that can take care of everybody. I don't know a farmer's market anywhere that's big enough that you could go down, say, 10% of the population could go down and buy enough produce to take home and can 400 quarts, 600 quarts, and see yourself through the winter. That's just not there yet, and we're going to have to get back to figuring out how to preserve food longer than we have been accustomed to lately. And there are going to be some old skills that we're going to wind up needing.
Resurrecting a little bit.
Yeah. Canning, for instance, which mm-hmm. a lot of folks have forgotten how to do.
Thanks, Larry, for calling. Appreciate it. Ruth and Shauna will give you a chance next. Ruth, hello to you.
Okay. Well, telling you the story that I lived. My husband came out of service in 46, came home to a former truck farm, all set to raise, be turned into a dairy farm, starting with buying calves and raising them until you had a herd. But what occurred in the meantime, the chemical companies started coming along and convincing farmers to that it's a waste of their time to cultivate and all that. They should spray their fields and the weeds won't grow. And I remember many an argument with a neighbor over that situation. My husband was convinced that manure is the best fertilizer, and from the barn, and then to return it to the soil. He had read a book by an author called John Falconer, Plowman's Folly, and he was just really convinced that that was the way, it was the natural way to do things. And so we, by the time we got a herd together, then the time came when the city, this is Green Bay, the city started developing, and the realtor, the agricultural property was taxes when were designated to be real estate, and apartments started going up, and the realtors come along and to buy, and you couldn't afford to live there because of the taxes increase and so on. That's how it forced us to give up. And
yeah. And that's a story that's been repeated more than once.
Boy, I'll say. And that's one of the problems that a lot of cities are trying to figure out how to deal with these days, actually for some time now. And that is how to contain sprawl, how to maintain some agricultural land around those cities. And that's getting, or remains, a huge issue. But you're telling us a story that is at once so personal and meaningful, and also pretty common.
Pretty common.
Yeah.
Ruth, thank you very much. I want to give some others a chance to get on here. Ed in Wausau, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Ed.
Hi, thank you for the program. About 40-plus years ago, I was on the Madison campus, and one of the professors that talked to us was saying how blessed we were in the Midwest as far as the depth of our topsoil. Some places, I guess, in Iowa, it exceeds 12, 15 feet. And whereas in South America, where they're converting some of the rainforest over, you're dealing in terms of inches of topsoil. But one of the things, I don't know if anyone's brought it up before, we're converting to, growing biofuels.
Yeah.
Has anyone brought up the fact that this is going to really put the pressure on the topsoil?
We're going to be talking about biofuels coming up, but comments from you, Gary?
Well, I guess I think topsoil is a huge issue. My granddad loved good topsoil. He had tons of it, rich, black dirt crumble in your hand. He liked to go out in the evening and just pick it up and hold it and sift it through his fingers. He just loved good topsoil. What folks tell me is that 50% of the topsoil that was on his place is gone. So we've had some huge topsoil losses, and corn and beans are part of that. And for the short term, at least, it's going to be corn and beans for American ethanol. And that means we expose the soil to greater losses due to water erosion. There's no ground cover then in the spring when we get our heaviest rains. And when it does wash off, it tends to leach the chemicals that you have to have in order to grow corn and soybeans out of that soil into the creek and down to the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. I think all that kind of sort of sociology of the soil is so apparent. And the ethanol thing is never going to save us all that much, I don't think. And it is going to take up some food land. And as by my lights, it won't relieve us of Mideast oil, partly because we're never going to have all the plants online that we have talked about having online and that the predictions are built around, because the one ingredient that nobody talks about in the production of ethanol is water. may not take any more water or even less to produce ethanol than it does to produce gasoline. But the fact is, more and more plants are being left on the drawing boards because some equivalent of a county commissioner's won't give them the water.
No.
So we're never going to have the number of plants that we expected to have, and the whole thing is not geared to be very workable, it seems to me.
Thanks, Ed, for calling. Bill in Lodi will give you a chance. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I guess I have to apologize. I'm going to have to inject a little pessimism, or maybe a little more. I don't know. I believe there's going to be three kinds of farmers in the world in 20 years, and two of them are going to be big farmers, the farmers that can milk and not cows, the farmers that can milk the government. I know of several farmers that have 7,000-8,000 acres under cultivation, but a percentage of the acres is under the husband, percentage is under the wife, percentage is under the daughter, the son. And the reason they do that is to maximize the amount of subsidies they can get. And the second kind of large farmer that will still be around and continue to get bigger are farmers that are farmers only by default. They're looking to write off what they're really making money at, such as trucking companies, cement companies, excavation companies, stuff, companies of that nature. And then the third farmer will be the, oh, by the way, yeah, I guess we farm too, such as the, unfortunately, the organic farmers of small 30, 40 cow herds.
Well, what do you think of that?
Are you asking me?
Gary, yeah.
I would disagree on the three kinds of farmers partly because there are two things working against the big commodity producers and the big payments. You're absolutely right in your description of who those folks are, but that's one reason to call your senator and urge him to vote for an amendment that should be offered on the floor sometime soon by Senators Dorgan and Grassley that would put real payment limits on what can be drawn. And it would prevent the double dipping, triple dipping, et cetera, and put a maximum amount that would be considerably less than it is now. So you might want to call your senator and tell him to vote for Dorgan and Grassley when it comes up. The other thing that's going to slow down the big guys is that the World Trade Organization and the other trade agreements that we have signed on with are going to end all the subsidies. So if we don't end them, then we wind up as we have been most recently by getting sued by the countries that don't have those supports. And they'll either end that way in the World Trade Organization panel that decides such things. Brazil won theirs, by the way, just recently, which means our taxes will go up in order to take care of the damages that we're going to have to pay. And the other thing is that I think taxpayers are catching on to that system that it mostly goes to big farmers, some already wealthy, and some non-farmers who are still claiming those payments. And I think taxpayers are going to get so fed up with that that they're just going to demand that we put a limit on it or change it somehow. And I'm hoping that was, I was hoping at least that that was going to be this year. It got taken out because of the pressure of the big guys. And the only hope we have of getting it back in is if Dorgan and Grassley pass this. So there's a little hope there yet. About the other two kinds, that's still up for grabs, except that I think because we're going to be local, we're going to have to sacrifice some of those commodity fields in order to grow food and feed ourselves. And it's going to be desperate enough that folks are going to demand that.
Well, Gary, you've written a provocative book, and I want to thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
It was great fun. Thanks. Thanks to Jim and Sharon and Marie and Larry and Ruth and Bill.
And everybody who called in. Gary Holthaus is the author of From the Farm to the Table, What All Americans Need to Know About Agriculture. It's published by the University Press of Kentucky. It was a real pleasure to have him on. And we're going to continue in a way to talk about agriculture because we're going to be talking about bioenergy and biofuels coming up next with Bruce Dale, professor in the Department of Chemical Engineering and Materials Science at Michigan State University. Next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.